So we're here with Professor Alison McConnell today. We're talking to Alison McConnell about respiratory muscle training, which is our learned topic for this month in the Physiopedia members area. So hello, Alison. Nice to meet you.
Hello, Rachel. Likewise.
First of all, Alison, I was wondering if you might be able to just, for those listeners that don't know you, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your work and the kind of, I know you do an awful lot of research and the sort of research that you do, just to sort of introduce yourself.
Of course. Well, I work at Brunel University in West London, and I'm an exercise scientist. My background is in respiratory exercise physiology, and I became interested in respiratory muscles having done a PhD at King's College Hospital in London. And my interest in respiratory muscles has been a very fascinating journey for me. It started with a relatively simple question, a research question essentially, and it has led me into commercial endeavours and a very exciting new avenue of research. So I'm a respiratory exercise physiologist, so perhaps not with the kind of background that many of your listeners and readers will be familiar with, but nonetheless, my interests are very pertinent, I think, to physiotherapy.
Definitely. I think, definitely the work you do, all physiotherapists really should take an interest in it. So despite you not being a physiotherapist, I think you have an awful lot to contribute to our profession. Just you mentioned that you started out with one simple respiratory question. What was that question?
That question was why do elderly people experience a greater intensity of breathlessness during physical activity than younger people? And I'd done some research on the control of breathing, both in younger people and older people, and found that there was no difference in the control system for breathing in older people, but they were less mechanically efficient. And I also found that their respiratory muscles were weaker. And so being a fairly sort of straightforward soul, I naturally thought, well, if their muscles are weak and they're experiencing what essentially is a greater intensity of effort that's associated with their breathing, what would happen if we make those muscles stronger? The neurophysiology tells us that what should happen is that they should feel less breathless and have a less breathing effort. So I looked around to see whether or not there were any devices available on the market at that time, and we're talking late 1980s now, and found that there was nothing suitable for my needs, nothing that I considered to give a reliable training stimulus to the respiratory muscles. So I set about devising my own device. And to cut a long story short, my technician built me a number of these handmade inspiratory muscle trainers. We had some research funding from a charity that was called Research into Aging. It's now part of Age UK. We implemented the inspiratory muscle training in a group of older people, and lo and behold, we discovered that their breathlessness was ameliorated after the training, and that was where it all started.
I think that's completely amazing that you came up. I mean, it's a really nice question to come up with as an initial research question, and especially still really pertinent today with the sort of increased age society, that the way this world is going. And really nice that you were able to take that research question and take it as far as developing a tool that actually ameliorated the sort of problem that you had come across.
Yes, and it was very satisfying. And what became even more satisfying was realizing that it wasn't just healthy elderly people that we could help with the breathing training, but that there were a lot of people with chronic respiratory and cardiovascular illnesses that we could also help in terms of their quality of life by alleviating their breathlessness. And the research has been a very long journey. The data now supporting the efficacy of particularly inspiratory muscle training in people with conditions such as COPD and heart failure, has now reached the meta-analysis stage in terms of its robustness. So there are meta-analyses now that support unequivocally the benefits specifically to breathlessness, but also to exercise tolerance and quality of life. So that's been very, very satisfying. And the fact that the device that I came up with originally as a research tool through the commercial endeavors that that I entered into became a prescribable device on the NHS in 2006 was particularly satisfying for me.
Really nice to see your research efforts being taken all that way and implemented into clinical practice at a level in the NHS. Like, that's great.
It is. One of the things that I found, though, is that that there remains a lot of scepticism, particularly on the part of physicians, about respiratory muscle training. I think they think it's too good to be true. And the NHS tends to be very pharmacocentric in terms of its approach to treating chronic illness. So they kind of think that, well, this is, you know, so inexpensive, it's so simple, it's so easy to implement. You know, surely there's got to be a catch, surely it can't work. And well, fortunately, the evidence there is sufficiently robust now. I mentioned the meta-analyses, and people are beginning to come around. I think the fact that exercise is now so entrenched within the care pathway, particularly for COPD and patients with cardiovascular disease, that it's helped, I think, of late. And I think particularly in the case of patients with COPD, exercise has been shown to be pretty much the most effective treatment you can give people. So I think the respiratory muscle training has slotted into that sea change of attitudes towards the treatment of that condition. But having said that, there's still a debate about whether or not the respiratory training adds anything to pulmonary rehab. And in fact, I'm engaged in a multi-center international trial at the moment looking at that specific question. But even if it doesn't add anything significantly to the main outcome measures that that we would wish to improve as a result of adding it to adding it to the pulmonary rehab, I think that there are other unmeasured benefits, if you like, that come from the respiratory muscle training, and those are areas that I've become more interested in as the evidence base for the obvious benefits, if you like, of inspiratory muscle training has become well established. So, for example, I've been working with a group at the University of Leuven who are physiotherapists who are interested in low back pain and postural control and falling. And we've rather surprisingly found that there is a relationship between inspiratory muscle function and people's postural control. And that, for example, we've always known that patients with COPD have a greater risk of falling, but the assumption has always been that that's because of peripheral muscle myopathy, and therefore, you know, their leg muscles need to be trained and strengthened in order to prevent the risk of falling. But what our research has shown is that the respiratory muscle work that these patients are, I suppose, preoccupied by means that the normal mechanisms that are involved in stabilizing the trunk are unable to operate. So they're kind of preoccupied by breathing. And so the multi-segmental control, postural control strategies that that these patients would normally, if they had normal respiratory muscle function, would use in order to prevent themselves from falling and losing their balance, are not able to be applied. So we've got some work going on at the moment to look at how inspiratory muscle training helps to improve balance and postural control in specifically in patients with COPD.
I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. I think from what you're telling us here is, you know, you started out looking at respiratory muscle training in aging individuals, the healthy ones and those with disease, I know you've also done a lot of work with athletes and in relation to exercise, but now you're getting quite specific and looking at things like back pain. And COPD is the obvious one that you must have worked on quite a lot over the years, but getting into back pain and falling, which are, you know, huge, huge parts of world health that we come across. What I'm hearing is that, you know, it's a really important part of anybody's, it should be an important part of anybody's knowledge repertoire that they can bring into any patient that they might see.
Very much so. People tend to think of the respiratory muscles as being, you know, just the diaphragm and the rib cage, for example. Yeah. But pretty much the whole of the trunk musculature has a respiratory function. And the same muscles that we use to stabilize the trunk, to stiffen the trunk when we're lifting things, as I say, prevent us from falling, those muscles are respiratory muscles. And what we found in athletes is that, for example, in rowers and in swimmers, whose trunk musculature is used as part of the propulsive action that's involved in the sport, that those athletes tend to exhibit the greatest respiratory muscle fatigue after exercise, and that the stiffening action of those muscles during the movement, whether it's rowing or swimming, and of course any other activity that involves the upper body, you know, kayaking, all those kinds of activities, that the fact that the muscles have to do those two things at once means that they are more susceptible to fatigue. And what's also been shown from some very nice studies in the 1990s is that when push comes to shove, in terms of those two roles of the trunk muscles, the respiratory function will predominate, fairly obviously, because that's the most important one. Yeah. So when you have a situation where respiratory muscle fatigue is present, the system is going to focus on the respiratory action of those muscles, which means that the stabilizing function is going to be attenuated or in some way diminished. And as a result of that, for example, in rowing, we have no direct evidence of this, but things like rib stress fractures and low back problems may actually be... the risk of those might be heightened by respiratory muscle fatigue. So these muscles are central to pretty much everything we do, and therefore I would recommend training them, not just from the point of view of the benefits that we've shown in our experimental research, but from the implicit benefits that would come from strengthening such an important group of muscles in the context of just whole body movement.
Yeah, and it sounds like this is a really important part of anyone's clinical practice, whether they're not just for people working in the cardiorespiratory sort of area, but also and with the athletes, as you mentioned, but also with older people, and I imagine in any neurology and in any situation. So just... So we've talked a lot about where you've been doing your research and where you see it's effective, the respiratory muscle training is effective and can have a good outcome. Can you, let's just go back to respiratory muscle training, and just for those who aren't quite familiar with what it is, can you describe respiratory muscle training for us, and just to give us a sort of overview of the term, really?
Of course. The respiratory muscles can be trained in the same way as any other muscle. The most widely used training stimulus, if you like, is resistance training. So what that normally entails is breathing against some sort of external device that induces a load at the mouth that you have to work hard against in order to provide the training stimulus for the muscles to adapt. So many years ago, I termed the phrase dumbbell for your diaphragm, and that's pretty much what we're talking about with a device such as the Power Breathe, for example, which is
the Power Breathe is the tool that you invented.
That's correct. Yes, yeah. And So we're applying resistance training principles. Originally, very early on, people poo-pooed the idea that these muscles were either trainable or that they exhibited any kind of adaptation in response to a training stimulus. It was thought that because they're active all of our lives, and that they're obviously their activity increases during physical activity, that that was a sufficient training stimulus to mean that the muscles were already in peak condition. But what has been shown unequivocally now is that using techniques such as ultrasound, we can actually demonstrate thickening of the diaphragm, so a hypertrophic response. And there have been some studies in patients with COPD where they've used open external intercostal biopsies. Obviously, you can't biopsy the diaphragm, not in a living person anyway. Yeah. So we do know that intercostal muscles show biochemical adaptations and also structural adaptations that are exactly what we would predict from any other skeletal muscle that we subject to a training stimulus. And that training stimulus is very specific. So if you subject the muscles to a strength training regimen, so relatively heavy loads with a small number of repetitions, then you get a strength training response, so a hypertrophic response. Whereas if you subject the muscles to a more endurance training stimulus, so low loads and high repetitions, then you get a more endurance biased response. I tend to favour the strength training because it's more time efficient and therefore more user friendly from the point of view of the patient. But also you get endurance benefits as well as strength benefits when you improve the strength of a muscle, because at any given intensity, it's working at a lower percentage of its capacity after you've trained it. So therefore, its endurance improves, its resistance to fatigue. So that's why I've always favoured strength training. And in terms of the effects on things like breathing effort sensation, endurance training, generally speaking, as endurance training of the inspiratory muscles, doesn't tend to improve the intensity of effort. Again, neurophysiologically, as we would predict, because the muscle hasn't got stronger. It's just that its endurance has improved. So those changes have been more biochemical than structural.
And so does it depend on your client whether you would use strength training or endurance training? Say, depend on whether they are an athlete or whether they have the disease or pathology? Do you modify the treatment for the client's presentation, your client's presentation?
Well, I exclusively go for strength training because of the dual benefits that we've identified. And the fact, as I said, that it is very time efficient. And most of the research evidence now, particularly in healthy people, strongly supports a strength bias training regimen. Now, what I'm talking about there is actually something that that if you were to talk to an athlete or a coach and say that this was a strength training regimen, would probably look at you and think, well, actually, that's more endurance training. But I'll explain why that would be the case. What we're talking about here is a moderate intensity load for 30 repetitions. And what we found repeatedly in our research is that improves strength, power, and endurance, takes less than 2 minutes per training session.
Wow.
And is universally effective in terms of the outcomes for both respiratory muscle performance and athletic performance.
So is that the same in people with and without disease, pathology?
Well, typically what's happened in the COPD research is that because there was a perception that perhaps these patients lacked endurance of those muscles, a resistance training device was used, but with a much longer training session length and a lower intensity. So they would typically load the inspiratory muscles at a low to moderate intensity and ask the patients to breathe against the device for, say, 5, 10, 15, sometimes even 30 minutes. What's happened increasingly is that studies are showing that shorter, more intense, higher loads of the kind that we've used in our athletes bring about better improvements in the function of the respiratory muscles in patients. And so that original preconception that what they actually needed was an endurance training program has shifted, and now people are using more intense training programs, and I think that's also, I suppose, paralleled in the shift that we've seen in terms of the kinds of whole body exercise training that is typically used in patients with COPD now, is that there's been a move towards interval type training, so more intense, briefer bouts of training, because those seem to be more time efficient, they induce less breathlessness, and the patients find them generally more agreeable than, you know, sitting on a cycle for half an hour at a time.
Yeah. And I imagine, so more time effective, and I imagine more cost effective as well, which everyone's always looking out for.
Yes, I think the shorter the time you can actually devote to a particular task, the lower will be the cost associated with it.
Yeah. Have you done any studies on, I know you mentioned earlier when we were talking about how the physicians are sort of saying to you, but this is so simple and so cheap, how can it be brought into practice compared to what we do now? Have you done any sort of cost effectiveness studies in relation to that sort of thing?
No, I haven't, and I would love for someone to do that.
Yeah.
Again, it's a question of resources and will.
Yeah.
I don't have direct access to patients myself, but if there's anyone out there who would like to look at the cost effectiveness of respiratory muscle training, say compared with whole body pulmonary rehab, for example,
yeah,
because there actually is, surprisingly, there's a meta-analysis out there that has shown that when you compare the outcome of pulmonary rehab with inspiratory muscle training for the major outcomes, that there is no statistical difference between the size of the effect that you see for respiratory training and pulmonary rehab. And given the cost and the limited access to pulmonary rehab in the UK, it seems to me that that's a cost effectiveness study that's begging to be done.
It does, definitely. And you mentioned about sort of accessibility as well, and your PowerBreathe tool, and I'm not sure if there are any others out there, but definitely with the inspiratory muscle trainers, it makes it so easy for anyone, clients, patients, to take this home and just do this at home in their own time. I imagine there's a lot more adherence with that sort of thing as well, and that you probably see better results because of that.
Yes, I think convenience is a real plus in terms of the respiratory muscle training over any other kind of training, because literally you can do it sitting in your armchair watching EastEnders.
It's, for 2 minutes.
It's that simple.
Only
for
two minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Fascinating. Well, this is all quite fascinating. And I know that you've done an awful lot of research, like you said, since the late 80s. And I think the culmination of all that research has been your book, Respiratory Muscle Training. And I've had a flick through your book, and it's an absolutely amazing piece of work. You've written whole thing yourself.
Thank you.
And I imagine it just, does this book bring together all your research of the last, I would say, 20 years, is that right?
Yeah, mine and pretty much the whole evidence base, if you like. I tried to make the book as comprehensive as I possibly could. So at the point at which I hit send and sent it to the publisher, it was as up to date as I could possibly make it.
What's the year? Last year it was published.
Yes, it was published last year.
Yeah.
But it is such a rapidly evolving sphere of medicine that it's already out of date, because people are doing new things and the evidence is being strengthened in different conditions. So I think there's definitely be scope for some updates in a year or so's time.
I mean, in publishing, there's always scope for updates, isn't there? But it's always really important that all the research is brought together in one place, so that we have one place to look at all this information and to learn about something that perhaps I certainly haven't come across. I'm a musculoskeletal clinician, or was, and I certainly haven't come across respiratory muscle training before, and it might just be because I haven't worked in that sort of field. But, looking at your book and listening to you talk today, like I just see how important it is for every clinician, every physiotherapist out there that's treating clients, patients, whether they be have pathology or not. And so the book makes it, brings everything together really nicely so that we can, you know, just, we can, well, I certainly can read it and have an understanding of respiratory muscle training and then perhaps take it forward into practice.
Well, I'm glad you feel confident enough in the information. That's a good sign. But yes, I think one of the problems that has existed for inspiratory muscle training is that a book like mine didn't exist.
Yeah.
And therefore, in terms of things like bringing inspiratory muscle training into the training of physiotherapists at undergraduate level and at postgraduate level was more difficult because there wasn't a sort of definitive tome, if you like, to which to refer. And because the literature, the evidence base is so immense, it was a sort of a Pandora's box, if you like, for lecturers in terms of, well, where do you start? I'm hopeful that what this will mean is that more and more undergraduate and indeed postgraduate physiotherapists will learn about inspiratory muscle training very early in their careers, and they will see the potential benefits of including it, as you say, in all aspects of their practice.
Yeah, and so is the sort of, not necessarily your book, but is respiratory muscle training, is that being incorporated into education now?
Difficult for me to gauge that. Obviously, I would hope so. It's impossible at the moment to be able to say whether or not the changes are happening.
And it can't just be physiotherapists that physiotherapists either. It must be other professions that have an interest in respiratory muscle training and are able to apply this to their client base.
Yes, I mean, I receive emails from obviously from athletes and coaches and strength and conditioning specialists, but also people who are involved in speech therapy. We've found that the inspiratory muscle training, because the extra thoracic airway, so the upper airway, is effectively a floppy tube. If you generate a large negative pressure in the chest, then that necessitates activation of laryngeal and other upper airway stabilizing muscles, which can result in a training stimulus. So again, I've been liaising with people who work on obstructive sleep apnea, laryngeal dysfunctions, particularly those occur during exercise in athletes, as well as in people who might have had stroke, for example. I'm finding that I'm interacting with all sorts of different types of clinicians. And again, the potential applications of this particular technique just seem to get broader and broader.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about speech therapy and things, you make me think about the application that it would have in sort of singing and performance and things like that.
Yeah, we've in the early days, we had some anecdotal evidence being returned to us when I was running the commercial company when we first commercialized the Power Breathe, and we were getting letters from initially we got letters from people who were said that their sleep quality had improved and all those kinds of things, and then we had some interactions with professional musicians and singers who were saying, you know, singers who'd been singing for 20 odd years saying, my range has improved, you know, this shouldn't be happening, I'm getting older, my range should actually be decreasing, but you know, my range is improving. And then wind instrument players saying that that the quality of their playing had improved, and they were also using it as part of their warm-up. So yes, it does have applications in those areas as well.
Yeah, it seems like you say, you're so on the money when you say it's the dumbbell for breathing. Like everyone has a dumbbell to get big biceps, but maybe everybody should have a Power Breathe as well, or a respiratory muscle trainer to improve other aspects of their life as well.
Oh, absolutely. I'm bound to agree with that.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the areas of research that I'm working on at the moment that I'm very excited about is the interaction between the respiratory and the cardiovascular system.
Yeah.
There have been some very interesting research showing that if you practice deep, slow, almost sort of meditative breathing techniques, that reduces arterial blood pressure in people with hypertension. And the reductions that you see in the blood pressure are really quite high. I'm talking sort of 15 millimeters of mercury or so, so 1.5.
Wow.
Now, that is the kind of level that you would hope to attain with a fairly complex pharmacological combination therapy. And of course, those drugs all have side effects. So it struck me as a very interesting area. And I was very intrigued and pleased to see that a study was published a couple of years ago showing that if you combine the deep, slow breathing with a small inspiratory load with an inspiratory muscle trainer, that magnifies the effect of the on the blood pressure. So a program of research that we're doing at the moment is trying to look at the underlying mechanisms for that response.
Yeah.
So that we can try to optimize it.
And is there, do you get carryover with that, with the reduced blood pressure?
In terms of a chronic reduction?
Yes,
you do.
Oh, okay, wow.
Yeah. So these are people who've been hypertensive. They are medicated to the best extent they can be, and they're showing reductions of 10 to 15 millimeters of mercury in their blood pressure after something, again, as simple as training their breathing, learning these deeper, slower breathing patterns. And also that there have been one or two studies with inspiratory muscle training showing that that has a beneficial effect on autonomic nervous system balance, but there's still not enough data there at the moment to be convinced that that's a genuine effect. But it's a really intriguing area.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear you talk about all the different. I've already said it today. All the different areas that this has an effect on, and that certainly is something that one of our global health burdens that maybe it can have an effect on as well. And so. So when I was reading up about this before speaking to you, I was sort of wondering, oh, I wonder if all you do is get one of these power breathe things and just breathe in and out all the time. But that's not the case, is it? Because I have a look in the back of your book, you have a chapter that has over 100 exercises in it for for respiratory muscle training. And some of the exercises that just relate to sort of breathing retraining, I guess. And then mm-hmm. others relate to using the inspiratory muscle training tool. And they go as far as doing things with balls and in functional positions and in demanding positions like the plank. And it really, when I look at the pictures in your book, it really makes sense. Some of the progressions that you've got in the book, it makes sense just to how sort of diverse the training programs can be. It's not just about breathing in and out of them. The inspiratory muscle trainer, it's about getting into different functional positions, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And even just, the breathing in and out of the trainer, it's not as simple as that. I mean, you'll see in the book that I talk about the importance of good breathing technique whilst mm-hmm. you're doing that breathing maneuver through the training device, because like any other kind of resistance training, you need good style, if you like, good form. So I go to some lengths to explain about how to optimize the training load, how to inhale and exhale through the device in order to promote those maximum adaptations, those optimal benefits from the training. And then superimposing the respiratory demand from the external device on these functional movements. And this is really coming back to this idea that the trunk muscles have this dual role.
Oh,
and the only way in which we can accommodate those two roles through training is to ask the muscles to do those two things at the same time. And this realization came to me actually through working with rowers. And I was working with, actually, it just happened to be the squad of rowers that won the eight that won the gold medal.
Matthew Pinsent.
It wasn't his crew, actually, although I couldn't possibly comment on whether Matthew Pinsent uses a power breathe, but but you'll see from the forward in my other book, which is the sport related book, that there is a forward from Matthew Pinsent.
So that's why I brought his name up.
You could draw your own conclusions.
Yeah.
But no, it was actually the men's eight that won the gold medal at the 2000 Olympics. And I worked with their coach, Martin McElroy. And he's a very a good coach who's very open to new stuff. And he, unlike a lot of coaches who kind of like to stay within a comfort zone in terms of their own expertise, Martin wanted to leave no stone unturned in terms of getting the best he possibly could out of his athletes. And so he gave me an opportunity to work with him and with the squad in preparation for the Olympics. And as part of that, and talking to the athletes and thinking, I used to row myself, and so I've got a little bit of insight into the sport. I began to think about the position in which the training was actually being undertaken, and thinking about the point in the stroke at which an athlete would breathe. And typically what happens with rowing is that there's entrainment of the breathing rhythm to the rowing rhythm for fairly obvious reasons in terms of that trunk stability that I spoke about earlier. And they tend to breathe at the end of the stroke, so at what we call the finish. So that's with the legs fully extended and the blade pulled into the chest. And then they breathe partway through the recovery. So as they're going up the slide, just before they put the blade in the water, they'll take another smaller breath. And those two positions are positions in which the respiratory muscles, for example, at the finish, they're working to keep the trunk in an upright position, so stopping you from falling backwards into the back of the boat. And in the just before the catch, you've got the obstruction of the abdominal wall by the thighs. So neither of those positions are particularly optimal for taking a good deep breath. So I suggested that what they might do is to actually try to train the inspiratory muscles in those positions. And initially, of course, they found it very hard. But to their minds and to mine, they were getting better benefit from the training because it was highly specific to the needs of the sport. And that led me to then start to think about how to make the inspiratory muscle training more functional for all different sports, and then to apply that insight to perhaps activities of daily living, if you like, for patients who've got respiratory and other conditions.
Yeah, and I guess your work with the rowers, that's what brought about some of the developments in the exercises that you've sort of written about in the book.
Indeed, right? Yes. Talking to physiotherapists that work with specific patient groups and identifying the types of activities that patients find particularly demanding. So, for example, patients who've got COPD, they find activities that involve their upper limbs particularly challenging. So, you know, brushing their hair, getting dressed, those kinds of things make them out of breath. And again, it's because the respiratory muscles are being required to stabilize the trunk during movements that are destabilizing and breathing at the same time. So to me, again, it made sense that what we should try to do is to devise some specific exercises that challenged those simulated and therefore challenged the respiratory muscles in a very functional way.
Yeah, definitely. I think it all sounds completely fascinating. And I just want to mention the other book that we talked about a moment ago is your other book, which is the one that has the foreword by Matthew Pinsent, is Breathe Strong, Perform Better. And that's all about respiratory muscle training for athletes, isn't it?
Am I right? That's correct, yes.
Yeah, so
yes.
You've got two books. The one that we're featuring this month is Respiratory Muscle Training, which is a theory and practice, and your other book, Breathe Strong, Perform Better, is about athletic training, really.
And that's correct.
Yeah, and I haven't seen your book, Breathe Strong, Perform Better, but listening to you talk and reading this first book, I'm no athlete myself, but I have been known to do some exercise, and all I want to do is read your other book and get a power breathe and have a go myself and see if I can make a difference.
No pun intended, but I'm glad you feel inspired.
Yes, I do, definitely. And I hope everybody else does, because it's completely fascinating, and And I think something that definitely, it's definitely one of those pieces of knowledge that all physiotherapists should have in their toolbox, because there may be situations where it just might be the key to opening the progression for their patient or their client or their whoever they're working with. So definitely a really interesting thing for people to have a look at. And that's something that I would recommend everybody to have a look at in whatever aspect of physiotherapy or clinical work they work in. So thank you very much for all the work that you've done on this.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure to speak to you. And it's also obviously been a pleasure to be involved in the research. Otherwise, I wouldn't have kept going all this time.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And so what we'll be doing is we'll be featuring your book and a learn topic this month on respiratory muscle training. And we'll be hopefully including, there'll be a couple of chapters from your book that people can have a sort of initial look at. And we'll hopefully include some of the exercises as well that you have available there, so people will be able to have a look at those. But so thank you so much for talking us to today. So I suppose if we could finish off, if you have, I mean, my message is that I guess that everyone should have a bit of knowledge about this and be able to have it at their disposal. But if you have one message for the physiotherapists out there, what would that be with respect to respiratory muscle training?
Well, I think the first thing to look at initially with any patient that's expressing a concern about their breathing or appears to be breathless is just to look at how they're breathing, because typically people breathe very badly. We know how to do it when we're infants, but somehow along the way we unlearn this connection with our diaphragms, and we develop these bad breathing habits. So the first thing to do with any patient that's complaining of breathlessness is to obviously having excluded any serious medical causes for the breathlessness, is to look at their breathing pattern, make sure they're using diaphragm correctly, that they haven't got a lot of tension in the shoulders, the neck, the chest wall, and encourage deep, slow, efficient breathing. So it's really just breathing pattern training is the very first place to start. And then if you want to build on that, then consider some inspiratory muscle training, because that's the type of training that's been shown to be most effective in terms of really getting to grips with breathlessness in people who are out of breath.
That's excellent. An excellent piece of advice, I think, for all clinicians out there listening to this. So thank you again. I don't want to keep you any longer, but thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you.